Ladies and gentlemen, we have an announcement to make. The Last 10% has just reached its 50th episode. Yeah! Celebration and revelry. Yes, that's how we're going to do it. We are so thankful to have made 50 episodes. Like 90% of all podcasts quit after episode 10 or 20. It's amazing. And so we want to take this time just to thank the listeners of The Last 10%. Over the last year, The Last 10% has been recognized for being in the top 10% of all podcasts globally. That's out of several million. And so we are excited about that. We have actually had listeners from 35 different countries in the last year, thousands of downloads, and new listeners every month. So we are so thankful for our listeners. And so I would ask if you guys have enjoyed content on this, if you just take 5 minutes, it would be a huge help for us on the podcast platforms. They like those reviews. And so if you like that, please review the podcast. And we're going to have some fun stories the next time that me and Danielle get on the podcast. I am going to tell the story why I sit in a 1905 Koch Brothers barber chair, because we wanted to do something special for episode 50. So thank you again for everyone who has listened to The Last 10% for 50 episodes. And we are going to now go on with the show for the 50th time. Thanks a lot. Hey, everybody. We're talking to Marlene Chisholm today. What an amazing woman. She works with leaders to build drama-free cultures that drive growth and reduce costly mistakes. She's also a great new friend of mine. You don't want to miss this incredible conversation.
Welcome to The Last 10%. Your host, Dallas Burnett, dives into incredible conversations that will inspire you to finish well and finish strong. Listen as guests share their journeys and valuable advice on living in the last 10%. If you are a leader, a coach, a business owner, or someone looking to level up, you are in the right place. Remember, you can give 90% effort and make it a long way. But it's finding out how to unlock the last 10% that makes all the difference in your life, your relationships, and your work. Now, here's Dallas.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. I am Dallas Burnett, sitting in my 1905 Koch Brothers barber chair in Thrive Studios. But more importantly, we have a great guest today. I know you guys are going to be super excited about. She has authored not one, not two, not three, but four books, and is an expert in anger management, difficult conversations, working with high conflict people, and has LinkedIn courses on all these topics. Wow. Welcome to the show, Marlene.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I really like your content and the books and all the LinkedIn courses that you have. And so I just wanted to, we were so excited to get you on the show today to talk, because people that are listening to the show obviously are having to have these difficult conversations and having to have conflict and deal with this conflict at work all the time. So I think you're in a great space. And so we're excited. But tell us first, how did Marlene get to be this speaker, consultant, author of all these books? What's your journey like?
Oh, Dallas, that would take several hours. I'll try to encapsulate it. You know, I was a worker bee for 21 years, and so I got a lot of experience on those front lines. And there, you know, workplaces in some ways have changed since that time, but they're also very alike in certain ways, in that there can be pockets of toxicity in cultures due to the management, due to the frontline leaders even, that are difficult to see if you haven't been at that frontline level. Mm-hmm. And so I just got to see that, and I wanted something more. I'd been there 21 years, and I thought, what is it I would like to do? And I went on this journey, and I call that journey the three life tragedies. And the first tragedy is you want something more, but you don't know what it is. The second one is you know what it is, but you don't think it's possible. And the third one is you know what it is, you think it's possible, but now you have to be willing to jump. And so what I did was, once I started thinking it was possible, I came to what I call that fulcrum point of change, where you have to make a decision. And I really still wasn't clear, even though a lot of what I work with now is clarity and I help leaders with their clarity. But the clarity I had was this: I'm not sure what I want and not even sure I can do what I think I want. But what I do know is this isn't it. Mm. And that was my decision-making point to jump off, finish up my master's degree. My master's degree was in, the capstone was Drama in the Workplace Hampers Productivity, the Effect of Relationships on the Bottom Line. And
wow.
I just kept seeing how health issues happen from toxicity, absenteeism, the keeping of employees, the talent management, everything has to do with drama in the workplace. And I just started seeing how all the dots connected. And that began my journey. And my journey started out as professional speaking. And then it evolved over time.
Oh my goodness. So what was the hardest part about making the jump from, you said, worker bee to professional speaker, and you've got a master's in between all that. So in your journey, when you said defining what it is, and then is it possible, and then taking the jump, for you, what was that hardest part of that process?
I think that we're either pulled by pleasure or pushed by pain. Mm-hmm. So I guess for both of those things for me is that it was pain. I saw in my mind's eye, and I was around 40, but probably started this journey of wanting something more. It lasted for 5 years, probably from 35 to 40. I think that's pretty common. People go through a midlife, pre-midlife crisis of knowing that, wow, the good fairy's not coming, the slipper's not going to fit, the great pumpkin is going to arrive. And so I think it was this pain. And I say that I saw a big retirement cake coming my way at the age of 65 or 70. Mm. And I thought to myself, if I don't choose something, that's going to be my reality, because there's not going to be something magical just occur. I have to take personal responsibility.
Yes.
And that's a part of my work is personal responsibility. But that fear of not having explored or even failed was worse than the thought of failing or not knowing what I want. And so I just couldn't imagine that was that reality. And I'm 65 now. So I've had that journey of knowing that if I wouldn't have taken that leap, I would be receiving my watch and a free chicken dinner and an extra 15-minute break. And I'd have a nice 401k and I could retire and still not know any more than I knew. And that was going to be my reality if I didn't choose.
Wow, man, that's awesome. I think that's fantastic. And I love your point about how the wake-up call was accepting the responsibility for creating the new path. And it wasn't like you blamed where you were. It wasn't like you were, you said, I'm going to get a retirement cake. You're not like, this company I'm with is terrible. They're bad people for giving me a retirement cake. You're saying, nah, it's not for me. It's not what I want. And so I think that's really healthy.
And you know, it's interesting because I understood this on some level that it's not a powerful place to be when you're blaming the place that's paying you. And providing your living to make them the bad guy, because it's your choice. You don't have to work there. There are other choices. Mm. And I often say that the first part of responsibility is the recognition of choice. What I tried to do when I couldn't see my choices is to say, even though I don't know what's out there, even though I don't know what other people do and how they built careers and how I was asleep at the wheel for these years, what I do know is that they do reimburse for college credits. So here's a choice I can take. My next step could be to take one class and see what I think. I do know that they are helping me to have a home that I'm paying for. I do know that they are providing me opportunities to put money in 401k. Even if I don't understand that, they are providing things that I don't necessarily understand. So I'll take the choices I know. And from that, you build more choices. But if you're constantly the victim, where they're a terrible place to work and you're just a cog in a wheel, and all that is probably true as well, but it goes along with what I learned in narrative coaching, that your story is the source of your suffering. So when you're telling yourself negative things about people in your life or your circumstances, it's not that there's not facts around that, but the narrative that you have about yourself, about other people, and about circumstances are going to either get you out of prison or set you free or keep you in prison.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really good. I love that. Your story is the source of your sufferings. I think that is so true. Oh, that is so true. And I couldn't agree more. So let's talk about this. You've actually just come out recently with your latest book is Conflict to Courage. What was something that inspired you, or was there a kind of an aha moment or an inspiration behind this book?
Yes, but yes, there was. I had been doing some work on difficult conversations. I had been hired by a large franchise organization to train their franchisees so that they could be better leaders and learn how to have difficult conversations. And the reason that had happened is because I started seeing patterns in the workplace that every big problem that emerged could be traced back to a conversation that should have happened but did not. So I did for 12 or 13 years. I was part of this leadership academy, that one little part I developed and delivered several times a year. And then when COVID hit, it was really interesting because I thought my business might just come to an end. And in a way, there was a freedom with that because I thought, if that happens, I have an excuse. COVID happened. I couldn't really be any more successful than I was because COVID happened, and I've learned about releasing resistance. So I'm just going to accept that. And in that releasing, finally, after that wasn't a problem, if that happened, I thought life is going to go on. I truly believe that. And everybody else is freaking out. I've already had my freak out. And that was when I left my factory job, right? I'm not going to freak out now. I know what that feels like. You just need to grab a hold of yourself. So I thought maybe how I could be productive is to think, and this was magical thinking, but it worked for me. I thought the good fairy is going to come along and someone's going to offer me a book deal. I don't know how it's going to happen, but I think it's going to happen. And so I started writing. Really? I started writing a proposal for difficult conversations. And fast forward in 2 months or so, I got an outreach by someone that was my first acquisitions person at LinkedIn, who was now an editor, a publisher at a British publishing house. She said, "Are you working on anything?" And I said, "I am, but it's really crappy." I said, "I'm glad to send it over because you don't normally do that. Normally it's polished, it's perfect. You don't have those kind of conversations, but it's COVID. She's trying to business too." So I said, "I can send it, just ignore all the typos and that it's not that organized, but I'm glad to show it to you." She's, "I love this. I love this." So we started talking and she said, "The problem is we just published one on difficult conversations. They would come out too close together. Would you mind doing something on conflict?" And I thought, I've always been good at when something's really close to what I teach, to expanding my knowledge and doing the research and making distinctions. And I said, "Sure." The bottom line is I rewrote it 3 times and it didn't get accepted. And it was devastating at the time because it ruined my story, my narrative. This was just going to be the magic fairy.
Right.
He said, "This is really weird." She said, "I've only had 2 books that I've worked that hard on myself," because they have to do work too to try to pitch it and polish it.
Sure.
"This is only the second one that hasn't published." She said, "I'm devastated too, but they don't like it. They think it's too, your book is too much on, too motivational, too personal development. It's not, it's, in other words, it's not dry enough and it's not academic enough." And I'm not going to be who I'm not. I'm going to be happy. I'm not even going to take one moment of sadness.
Yeah.
I just decided that. And I said, "This is unheard of too." I said, "Could you introduce me to a different publisher? Because usually they don't do that." And she said, "I will." She said, "I will." And that was, I got Barrett Kohler and they published it. I told them, I said, "I'll rewrite it one time." But I'm like, at the certain age, this was pretty entitled of me in a certain way, and I might be different even 2 years later, but I said, "I'm only willing to rewrite it once, because if we're not clicking, if there's drama in the boat, there's going to be drama on the island, and I'm just not going to be different than I am. Either you like where I'm coming from or you don't, and it's okay if you don't. It's just dating. Don't waste time if the second date is horrible." You know what I mean? And so just decided that, and he said, "I've never heard an author talk to a publisher like that." And I said, "I'm just saving time. It's no means of disrespect, but there's no reason to appease or pretend or avoid. Let's just tell the truth that we're not a fit." And okay. And it worked.
Wow, man, that's incredible. So you'd already started writing it and you're going on this roller coaster ride. You think this is my ticket. This is my, you know, magical fairy. And then it doesn't happen, but you keep plugging away. I love the boldness that you have. And I think it speaks to conflict and courage, because even in this situation, you kind of were demonstrating that, in the sense that you're having this conversation with this person that's pitching your book and it's, "I don't understand. It's not going well." And even though your conflict with that person's not, you're really having conflict with the publisher because they weren't publishing the book.
Yeah.
But it took a lot of courage for you to tell the person, "Hey, I know this is not the norm. I know this is not what we normally see, but I need you to get me out of this game, put me in a different game. Give me another publisher." And because of that, it worked out. So I think that's really cool. Can you tell us I would love to know, when we talk about conflict, what is some of the most difficult conflicts that you've seen in working with teams and leaders? Because a lot of listeners of Last 10% are leading teams. They are leading organizations. some leading families. But what, when you think about conflicts, what's some of the most difficult conflicts to navigate in your opinion?
Love that question, because here's a tenet of my work, is that conflict itself is not the problem. We all think it's a problem. Then we've got the motivational speakers that says, it helps you grow, you ought to embrace it. Yeah, I love it. I'm not that person. I don't like it. I don't want to embrace it. I don't feel good. Like, I know it doesn't. Right. Well, I'm not going to pretend it does. My saying, though, is that conflict itself is not the problem. Mismanagement is the problem, because the more complex our world gets and the more divided we get politically and so on, conflict is going to be there. But it itself is not the problem. The problem is how we manage or mismanage it. What the first way that we mismanage conflict is in the way we define it. So we think of it as, oh, they're going to, I'm going to lose my favor with them, or they're going to yell or gonna scream. I don't like them. They're hard to get along. We do all that kind of stuff. We get in the way with all these stories and narratives. Mm-hmm. If you can stop for a moment and say, okay, what is conflict? It's opposing drives, desires, and demands. So if you think of two arrows going in opposite directions, and you say, okay, I feel this anger toward them or this fear toward them, but let me take a step back and say what? It's opposing drives, desires, and demands. Just like with my publisher. She's not my enemy. She has to work with her people that's in charge of her. And there's an opposing drive that they have that I can't possibly understand. And I don't need to understand it because they're the decision maker and they said no. So it's an opposing drive, desire, demand. If they're not willing to further the conversation, they have a right as the leader to decide. And I have a right as someone that may or may not want to work with them to decide differently. So if it's opposing drives, desires, and demands, and you really believe that, it makes you curious. Because even if you don't win, you go, this may not be my right publisher, but what drive did they have? Because now you've got new intel for the future. You're not like freaking out, but they were terrible. They only wanted to. And so you say it was a different drive. And I wasn't in that direction because they already had one that was on difficult conversations. They wanted mine to be more academic and more like what I would call dry, not my type of writing. Right. And so not going to work out anyway because they're not open to a new way and I don't want to change. So there we are. So opposing drives, desires, and demands. And so once that's the first mismanagement, then and I know I'm talking generally here. I'm glad to get into some specifics if you want that. But once you understand the foundation of it, it becomes pretty easy. And so the ways that I see managers mismanage conflict is what I call the three A's, which is avoiding, appeasing, and aggression. And avoiders know that they avoid. They will say things like, I hate conflict and I try my best. I put things off if I need to have a conversation. I know that I avoid and I'm so scared to learn the skills because it just feels bad. They know that.
Yes.
The other two don't know that they avoid. Like appeasers, they just view themselves as, I'm just congenial. I like people. I'm a people person. And what they do is they say things like, love your idea. I love it. Love you. And they don't love it. And they're not going to go tell the boss what this person thought because they're just playing both sides of it. I love you. Gotcha. It's great. Glad you engaged. However, the reason this won't work is this, and I want you to be educated on that because I love your engagement. However, this tells me you need to learn more about business operations, and I'm glad to train you on that. That's a different conversation than you're engaging. Love it.
Right.
On the agenda for next quarter. So those are the appeasers. They tell people, let's do lunch. Like it. Gotcha. We'll put it on the calendar, and they don't. And then you're wondering, they're so nice. How could they do that? Oh, they're just forgetful because they're so nice. Mm. There's really this price to being nice because being nice is in favor of honesty and truth and elevation.
Right.
That's another kind of avoiding. And those people do not know they avoid. Aggression, people that are very aggressive also do not know they avoid. And I had a very aggressive boss when I worked in the factory. But aggressive people feel, and this is so interesting on surveys, they always give themselves nines and tens on how effective they are at difficult conversations. What that really means is I'm going to bully my way to you acquiescing to me. And I feel great about it because I won. And this is how the cow eats the cabbage. I will tell you what to do and you're going to do it. And people know who's the boss. The buck stops here. But the truth is people don't like those kind of leaders. They don't feel like they got their back. There's no intimacy. There's no real conversation. We already know what that boss is going to say. I didn't ask you to work here. That's just the way it is. And if you don't like it, find yourself another place to work. Well, that person's beating their chest going, God, I'm so good at this. They're terrible. So they don't know they avoid personal growth. development, critical thinking, they're avoiding those things in favor of just getting something done to look good. So it's all avoiding, and that is how a conflict is mismanaged, and I see it all the way from the top to the front line.
Mm. So you said the three A's, avoiding, appealing, aggressive, but really avoiding is undergirds all of those. It's just whether or not you're actually aware, aware if you're avoiding or not. So if you are, let's say one of our listeners is an aggressive, or maybe they were listening just now and they went, oh my gosh, I thought I was the one that handled those conversations. She just nailed me right between the eyes when she said that. What is someone that lacks awareness, whether it's appeasing or aggressive, how can they combat their unawareness of how they avoid these conflicts?
I think they'll want to learn. They'll say, okay, what do I need to learn? First of all, it'll hurt at first. There's two sayings, the truth will hurt or the truth will set you free. Yeah. If it hurts, then you have an ego where you need to be important. You need to be right. And you're going to appease because you're just a nice person on the disc. You're an S. And if you're rude and aggressive, you're a D on the disc and you need to be right because that's just the way you are. And you're just being authentic. But you can either make excuses or you can make growth happen, right? If you want to grow, you're going to bump up against, and this is the shortcut. There's two things you probably need to look at. Your inner game and your outer game. Mm-hmm. So your outer game is the skills development. And most organizations, if they offer development to the mid and front line, which they don't very often, but if they do, it's something like, I love LinkedIn because I have courses there. It's something like that where it's all digital, or it's some sort of a course that, you know, certification from 5 Dysfunctions of a Team, and they have a trainer come in. And it's pretty surface, in my opinion. And I love those authors and so on, too. But it's not coaching and it's not real deep self-awareness and practice. It's just an idea or an understanding of it intellectually, which only gets you so far unless you're a real self-development person.
Right.
The idea is going to be, well, I think I need skills development. And skills is part of the equation. The other part of the equation, though, is what I call the inner game, and that's your fortitude, your character, your self-awareness, the feeling of fear when you have to have that conversation and you do it anyway and you get coaching and mentoring. That's an expansiveness internally, so that's inner growth, and very few people focus on inner growth. They focus on skills, and what they don't realize is they focus on skills for the purpose of manipulating and changing someone else. Skills for the purpose of you being a better person and learning to radically listen, saying something just the right way. So it worked. They did it. And I teach those skills, but there's always underneath it is the right intention, because without that, people feel it all the way to the bank and back.
Wow, that is such an amazing statement. I love how you correlated the outer game. And when somebody's pushing you into that, or you're doing that, a lot of times it's to manipulate or change someone else. I think that is a natural, because it's easy. It's easy to see. It's easy to address. It's easy to go to, like you said, LinkedIn, hit the course, get this, check this box.
Certification.
Okay, I've got the certification. I could be the worst at whatever that is, but I've got the certification. And I think that's so true. And I love how you talked about that from a mindset standpoint. If I can get you to think well, then the rest will fall in place. You can learn what you need to learn, but if I can get you to think well and in alignment, that's really good. So if someone was working and had either they were leading a team or coaching someone, and the person that they were coaching was aggressive or appeasing, what advice would you give a leader that's trying to deal with employees on their team that are just really, they create a lot of conflict?
What you're going to hear when you have to work with someone that's very defensive or aggressive, you want to avoid that conversation because there's this saying, I already know what they're going to say. They're going to get defensive and they're going to say something to derail the conversation. They're going to say, look, that's not fair, or I'm feeling harassed, or you ought to hear what other people are saying about your leadership, because what they're trying to do, I say, they're the fisherman and you're the carp. And they throw a big juicy worm on there and you're going to bite that worm and get hooked into this different conversation. So you have to be aware of these. They're not intentional. People aren't that manipulative to where they're intending, I'm going to say this. They don't do that. It just happens because we human beings defend ourselves when we feel threatened. The primal brain goes into survival mode and the front prefrontal cortex shuts down. So it's not like someone plans it. It's just what people do. So you can't be real psychological about all this and say, oh, they planned that. No, that's just what they do. So you've got to be ready that it's going to happen. And then you're going to hear something like, look, I'm just being authentic. Do you want me to be fake? I'm just a straight shooter. They're going to say something like that.
Yes.
So you're going to listen and you're going to say, here's a question. Is that who you want to be? Like, because really, it doesn't matter. I can be authentic to all parts of myself. I can be the three-year-old that's disappointed and throws a fit and pouts and doesn't talk to you for 2 days. I can be authentic. I'm just being authentic. Or I can say, yeah, that's what I feel like doing, but there's a part of me that wants to grow. So I'm going to take a moment, ask for a boundary of time, and then we're going to get back in the conversation. I can be authentic to that. And that's still authentic, even though I feel angry, even though I feel discounted. It's still authentic because my bigger authenticity is I want to grow. So what you want to do is inspire people to look at themselves and to say, is this who you are? Is this who you want to be? This is the business. This is what this is costing our business when you do X, Y, and Z. So when I'm teaching conversations about difficult, when I'm teaching my process for difficult conversations, there's actually a process you work through before you even have the conversation. But what you want to be able to do is speak to the observable behavior, not to your perception of what's going on. Look, you're just trying to intimidate everybody. Look, you just think that you're all that in a bag of chips and you're trying to intimidate. No, that's just your story about it. But you could say, Ralph, I noticed last week in the meeting, you interrupted Susan 3 times. And then when John brought up another point, you rolled your eyes and you crossed your arms and everybody shut down. Not anyone participated after that. Did you recognize that? I was just being authentic. I understand, but here's the question. Are you committed to others engaging and hearing other points of view? Because that's what I need. And this is how this is affecting our team.
Yeah.
Because if I say that this is a behavior, I'm not judging you and your character, but I'm saying this is what you do. This is how this is affecting our team. Walk me through what's going on for you when you do that. Well, I just don't think people should be so stupid. I just think they ought to get it and da 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 do their homework, whatever, and say, okay, so when you say that, that sounds to me like there's a lot of persecution and judgment of your team members. And this is also a problem with how we interact with each other. Are you hearing that? If I called you stupid, how would you respond to that? Well, I mean, that's just how I talk. You know, you're going to get
I have had, it's so funny. It's so close to conversations I've had with people in the past. It's just fascinating. It's awesome. Oh, that's so good.
So you start from a higher place of what you do is you clear your own energy and you don't get triggered. And you know that they're going to try to trigger you because that's what people do when they shut down. You would do it too if it was you and you're being called out on something that you weren't aware of. So just be fair about that. But clean your own energy and see them in the fullness of who they could be with some development. Because when you envision that person to be, whether it's a better leader and better team player, because they obviously have some skills and talents they bring to the table. So you can always say, here is the vision I have. You said you wanted to be the supervisor. You said that. Do you still want that, Ralph? Well, I do. And I think I'm a great leader. I do the best of anyone here. Of course you do. You're a performer. However, the skills of being a leader are different than being a worker bee. And so I want to explain that to you. Because this is how you'll have to shape yourself and work on your inner game if you want to do that. And so once it makes sense to them, because a lot of people, especially, and I was on those factory floors and I thought it was all about just if you're a good worker, you're good at everything else. That's not how it is. Honestly, there's things that I do with higher level leaders that I cannot do myself. And I always say, just consider me the bald man telling Nadia to point her toe on the balance beam. You're Nadia, I'm the bald guy. And I couldn't do it this mouth, but I can tell you when your toe's not pointed.
I love that. Oh, that's so good. That's so good. Oh, that's really great. I love how you've positioned that. If you're leading a team, there's so many things that you said that resonated with me and a great deal. Number one, where you started that all was if you're leading someone who is aggressive or even appeasing, they're either creating conflict or doing things or they're not handling it well. The first thing that you led with was you want to inspire those people.
Yes.
You want to inspire. It's going to aggravate us because we're like, this is a thorn in my side. If they would just do this, we'd be so much better. So you're already approaching this from a real negative energy. Like you said, I loved how you also said, you got to clean your own energy first.
You do.
And you got to do it. Isn't that amazing? So when I come to this person as a leader, if I sit down across from the person and I'm already in a position where I'm frustrated at them already, then it's going to go downhill. I can't have this conversation and keep it level, because as soon as they come back at me with something not relevant, or I'm just going to, it's going, it's ready. Off, it's ready.
We're going to go into the kill.
Yeah.
We're going to go into the kill. And I often say, there's a couple of things you have to do. You have to get yourself centered first, but I call it standing on the bridge. Mm. And I got that from an author, might have been Gary Zukav, I can't remember, and I hate to not give attribution, but the way that the language that I use, I call it the language of the island. We're in a boat, we're all in the boat, we're trying to get to the island. As a team, it's all of us trying to row together. But mm-hmm. if people start beating each other with the oars, then, and there's a leak in the boat, we as the leader have to recognize that's happening. Otherwise, we're sitting there blaming the raging river. What you've got to do is stand up on the bridge and watch the beating and watch the draining and watch the island, because then you can see that from perspective, you're not in there helping down the water yourself, trying to survive. This is what's happening. And you can even say, look, we're beating each other with the oars here. Are we rowing in the right direction? And the bully is going to say, look, I'm the one that's the best rower. So, yeah, I had to bop them over the head because they were being stupid. So, you know, you're like, yeah, but that's not the way we work as a team, right? And you have to start to see, I say there's three positions in the boat. The top leader, they want to get to the treasure chest on the island. The manager wants everybody to row harder and faster, and the rower just wants a better seat cushion on the boat. So we all want something different. And you have to stand on the bridge and say, are we talking about seat cushion, rowing, or island right now? What are we talking about?
Wow. I love that. Standing on the bridge. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that helps, because when you're talking about leading others, if you can separate yourself just a short distance, it helps you get so much more perspective. Like you said, and I think that's a great visual of that. And I think, too, it helps you see the event with more empathy and more understanding so that you can approach it. I love how you narrowed down the conflict to a behavior instead of a person. And I think that also comes with that perspective. If I'm feeling like I'm looking at it from the bridge, then I'm not feeling like I'm getting slapped in the face with these oars. It just feels different to me. So then I can approach those conversations with more maturity and more level-headedness and more empathy. And I think that's so good and less likely to get triggered. So I think that's really good. I think that's great advice for leaders out there and going into difficult conversations and managing sometimes difficult people. Because again, I think it goes back to we really want to change people and grow them. We have to give them something that they feel like they're capable of changing and doing. It's if you give me something, and if you made the comment, the bald guy telling the point, if you said to that guy, no, you've got to get up on the balance beam, point your toe, that's something that's so far out of his, he can't do it. He can't grasp that. But if when you, like you said earlier, when you relate it to behavior, it's saying, hey, look, you crossed your arms and lean back and everybody disengaged. Oh, if you don't cross your arms and don't lean back, then everybody will stay engaged. That's something I can manage. Oh, I can do that or not do that. And I think that's just a real simple, it's a fundamental building block of this. But I think you're very wise in giving that advice. That sound means it's time to take a break and hear a word from our sponsor. If you lead an organization or a team, one of the biggest challenges you face is developing your people. Think Move Thrive is here to help you on your journey. We've developed a coaching system that integrates into your team or organization to consistently develop your employees, build trust, gain valuable feedback, and increase accountability. Leadership retreats and summits are great. We even build those custom for our clients, but they're only part of the solution because they lack consistency. Our one-on-one coaching app is the missing piece in your employee development program. We help new leaders get to know their teams. We help technical managers be more relational, and we help ensure that your relational rock stars stay organized. We developed the system for a client, and it was so successful, we created the app to help more organizations develop their people, build trust, engagement, and you guessed it, performance. For more information, go to thinkmovethrive.com to learn more about the one-on-one coaching system and start developing your team today. Back to the show.
What's fun too, this shocks leaders, because I say there's a couple of ways to do this. Let's say that you're having a meeting and I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but in every corporate situation, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's whatever it is, there's always the one spokesperson that, and I told them in the meeting, and everybody, you told me, but he was thinking, well, what about the firing that happened last week? I thought we were all about letting people be themselves, and you wouldn't let him wear the t-shirt. That's right. They're incongruent. But leaders don't know how to handle that whenever they're like frontline or mid, and even sometimes top leaders don't either, but they don't know what to do with that spokesperson. You've got to set expectations before a meeting. We're not going to be talking about the issue that happened 3 weeks ago. And if we do, that's going to be tabled. You have to do that. But if you don't, and someone starts spouting off and crossing their, I always just use the example of crossing their arms and rolling their eyes and letting out a big sigh, you got a couple of choices. You can go, hey, Cliff, did you disagree with, I noticed that you just crossed your arms and you rolled your eyes. Now, you got to be careful because they might go off on a rail, but usually it surprises people for you to say it in the moment of what they did. Not, don't react to the behavior, the meta message. Don't go, okay, look, we're not going to have, like, you don't get triggered. I noticed that it's very linear and logical. And then they're going to go, oh, no. Even if someone says something real sarcastic, was that supposed to hurt my feelings? That sounded like that was a dig. Oh my God, no, you're just too sensitive. They're always going to throw it back on you. I was just cold and you're too sensitive. So what you do is that what objection dies on agreement. So you go, I could be, but here's what I need from you. You don't go into the argument of, no, I'm not. That was what you were doing. I know what you intended. I wasn't born yesterday. Now you're in a fight. Now you're in the island called verbal ping pong. You don't go there. You say, I could be. I can see why you might think that, but this is what I'm needing from you. I had, when I was at the frontline worker, and I'd have these conversations with my boss from the lowest level. That's what gave me the courage to do it now. But I remember saying to him, you seem really unapproachable. And I picked up that buzzword because that was the big word they were teaching managers, to be approachable. Someone got their master's degree and they were teaching people, you need to be approachable. This is the new thing. This is the new five ways you become approachable. So we pick up on that, right? The front lines. We know what the latest buzzword is, quality circles and black belt this and whatever. So we know those things. So I said, well, you just seem really unapproachable when you act like this, when you say these things. And he says to me, no one can make you feel anything without, he was quoting Eleanor Roosevelt, no one can make you feel anything without your approval. And I said, perhaps that's true, but now that I've told you, if you keep doing it, you do it with knowledge.
Touche.
And he goes, he never did it again because I called him out on behavior to say, you can justify it all day long. You can quote Eleanor Roosevelt. You can open up the Holy Bible, whatever you need to do. But I'm telling you that this bothers me and you continue to do it, which tells me you do it knowing it bothers me. And if I don't say anything, you can go, just your perception, and no one can make you feel anything.
Yes. No, I think that's so true. And it's probably, he's had that quote from Eleanor Roosevelt for quite some time. I'm sure he used it ongoingly, and a lot of people walked away just scratching their heads. What's he talking about? I guess it is right. Do I need to give him permission? And then you just pinged him right between the eyes.
That's why you don't really argue with their reasoning. You just go, that's how they reason, right? And that's how they justify bad behavior. Sure. You just, that could be, or hey, you're just a female and women are sensitive. Like, I get that. That's probably right. Could be a hormonal day for me, but here's the thing. This is what I'm
I love that. I love that. That is so good. Oh, you said it. Objection dies with agreement. That's the first time I've ever heard that. And I love it. And that's so true.
That was not my fault either. I think that person was Marilyn. I think that's the right name. And it was an old sales book back in the 50s and the 60s. They had some great books back then, like even Leading with Intimidation. There's all kinds of great titles to books.
Yeah.
When you first read it, you're like, that sounds terrible. But it was really good what they taught. And these are, I would say, on the border of manipulation. They're the outer game. It's the outer game that you have in your back pocket.
Yes.
So you have to use it sparingly. Otherwise, you're just a sarcastic person that's memorized a bunch of one-liners.
Right.
And I enjoy those because they're fun. But your real intention, Like, I'm sarcastic. That's something I had to work on.
But yeah, no, you want to use them like a surgeon and a scalpel. It's very, like, you know exactly when and how to apply it. And if not, you're going to bludgeon someone with something that's just not going to work out well. So I agree. But I do think that principle is so fascinating, because even if you don't have the one line comeback, the idea that objection dies with agreement is it's a principle, like, because there is no objection if there's an agreement. So let's figure this out and we can work together on that idea. And so anytime
even if someone says, that's not fair, to be able, you don't throw back, well, no one ever said it was fair. You just go, that could be true. There is a lot of things, and I get that you perceive that. And you could say, walk me through why you see it that way. You could do that, or you could say, I do understand, and unfortunately, I still have to implement, regardless of what different people, this is coming from above, and I have to support that, and I do support it because of my role. I understand your role, and so we have to find a way to come together. Are you willing to explore that? So there's ways to still have the objections die in agreement and not be sarcastic, like I've been showcasing today. Those are just kind of things to do, but really, it's coming from a philosophy. Like you said, if you've got a hammer, everything's a nail. I have lots of hammers, and I used to use those all the time. And my growth was to work on not doing things that come easy to me, which is to do the one-liners and the sarcasm. And those are easy for me.
It's conceding a small point to win the war. You've expressed a problem, and he's putting this, you know, ridiculous saying that from Eleanor on it. And what you're saying is, okay, fine, I just won't argue that point. I'll give it to you. But then you're going back. You're just pulling it back to the thing that's most important. And I think about when you're dealing with conflict, I think that's really trying to stay on the root of the issue and addressing that and not getting it off on all these tangents. Because I think as team leaders, as business owners, when we engage in these conversations, there's so much emotion going, whether we're in it or whether we're on the bridge, there's so much emotion going that it's just really easy for things to go, because people are deflecting and they're not wanting to take this. They're throwing off on that and they're angry about this, and all these things come out. So we've got all these deflections going over, but the real reason that we're coming together is to solve this. And sometimes we get sad. So I love that, you know, let's agree on all this other stuff for now and focus on what really matters.
That's how avoiding the distraction and setting, like, part of the, I call it performance coaching model. I also call it the blueprint for difficult conversations. But since there's so much coaching in it, I'm really referring to it as the performance coaching model. And the very beginning of a difficult conversation, after you've assessed and done your inner work and you've looked at the behaviors and who you're talking to and what's going on, there's a method for that. Once you've got that done, and once you do it two or three times, you don't need to keep doing it that hard every time, because it becomes a part of how you think. But the first thing you do is you set the intentions. Let's say someone's sales numbers are terrible. You don't say, okay, my intention for this meeting is to talk about why your sales suck. No, we don't do that. We say, look, my intention for this meeting is to find ways to help you elevate your sales. Because we're speaking to the outcome from a positive perspective, not to the shark that's between the island and the boat. We're not speaking about the problem. We're speaking about the outcome. Yes. When I said, love to meet with you today for the purpose of talking about elevating our teamwork. And what I've observed is that when there's a couple of people that when they speak, you either interrupt or say something very sarcastic. For example, the other day, what I want you to understand that I'm here to support you, to help you grow. What I don't want is you to think you're the only one, or that I'm just making you the bad guy. But this is how this is affecting the team. And then that's how you lay out the first part of the conversation. Then when you say, so walk me through what's going on for you when this happens, and they say, I just don't think it's fair. Let me tell you, I understand it's not fair, but the question was, walk me through what provokes you to, I think you're just picking on me. You're just making this a big deal and it's really not that. No, I understand you think it, but I'm asking you a really serious question. Walk me through. You sit on the side because you are going back to the question that you've asked, and you're not going out here going, I don't care if you think it's fair. I don't think it's fair that you're beating people up. Now you're bop, 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 bop. It's not going to get you anywhere.
Oh, that's so true. And I don't know. I just think that's it's a fantastic approach. And I think that when we're engaging in those difficult conversations, I think especially for people who obviously are uncomfortable going into it. If you have a leader, like we talked about avoiding earlier, and you're like, oh, I really am not looking forward to having this difficult conversation, I think one thing that you're saying that should be very encouraging to everybody listening is that we don't have to make it more difficult than it is if we just focus on behavior and outcome, because those are things that are within our control, or at least our intention. And so I can share that behavior and I can say, it's our intent to have this outcome. Is that your intent? It is. Okay. This is how the behavior doesn't equal this outcome. And now it's A plus B equals C conversation, and everybody can do algebra, and that doesn't seem very intimidating, but having all these emotions really do. And so I love that approach. I love it. I love that.
It's
so
good. And it's really a skill. It takes a little bit to learn. And if you're like, oh, I can't take it, this takes so long. Should it take this long to learn? Yeah, it does, because you're reprogramming yourself. But once you learn it, it's like sharpening the saw. And then each skill stands alone, so that the performance coaching model that I created was based on this framework, that you've either inherited a problem that you let go on for too long after you inherited it, or you never approached it in the first place. Therefore, it's a difficult place to start because you were part of the problem. Once you actually do this longer conversation and we're back on the same page and we set up another meeting for accountability, and there's certain skills or certain processes or certain ways that we need to check in, once you've done that and your real purpose was to elevate them or to get to the truth of the matter, which the truth may, they've not liked the job for a long time, and you've both realized it's not the right fit, which is fine because you're leaving as friends. But let's say they do have the skills and aptitude. They just needed a course correction. They needed some attention. You're back on track with their accountability. In the future, it's not a long run. My purpose for this call, it's not like that anymore. It's, hey, I noticed that you da da da. Or it's, hey, what I want, what I don't want. It's just you're using the skills over and over to get right to the point versus come to the office today at 2:00. My intention for this conversation, like you're not doing that every time. You're not doing that because you won't. You don't have time for it.
No, you don't have time for that. Yeah. No, I love that. That's really good. So I have a question. If someone is in the avoiding, we've talked about the aggressive and appeasing, but if someone is in the avoiding camp as it relates to conflict and difficult conversations, what are things that people can do to move to a place of courage, to having courage? It speaks to your title, but if I want to move from being a person who's like total avoidance to a person that has courage in conflict, what's that process look like for me?
You have to be willing to be uncomfortable. That's really the bottom line. And be uncomfortable just a little at a time until you expand. I call it expanding your conflict capacity. If you're committed to comfort, then you're never going to get it. And I understand that people have been traumatized and people have programming. I really do. And I'm not a psychologist. Unless it's been severe trauma, which if it is, you probably wouldn't be in a leadership position anyway.
Sure.
But we've all had some things that happen to us in programming that makes us scared. The bottom line is you don't like how it feels. And so you're in resistance. I want to share something about resistance because I think this will be real important. So the reason people avoid mostly is not due to skills. If it is, if you get the skills and you're still avoiding, the skills can take off. It can shave off 4 or 5 points of stress because you feel confident and you've got a pattern and a way to start. And you might mess up, but you're excited to use it. If you've practiced and you know the theory and you're still really scared to death just to even correct one thing or to make one criticism, it's because of how you're thinking for some reason. You're thinking that you're hurting someone's feelings versus helping them improve. It's like staying in a marriage and pretending you're happy because you don't want to hurt their feelings. But the truth is you don't have a real relationship. So you've got to want for their betterment and your betterment more than you want to be comfortable. And so when you look at it from that perspective, you say comfort's not a requirement. And so when we talk about resistance, and I just do lots of programs on resistance. In fact, I'm going to be having a program that's just on resistance. It's an online course because I think people need this. The understanding is that there's three layers of resistance. So the first kind of resistance is if you're an avoider, you're likely to avoid. I just don't want to do it. I hate it. It feels bad. I know that about myself. Let's say I think I've bettered myself in that way, though. I'm willing to be uncomfortable. So now I'm looking at their resistance. Okay, they're defensive. They're sarcastic. They're going to blame me. They're going to get me derailed. And I know what they're going to say. So I know that their negativity, I know that is a level of resistance. What we think that we're resistant because of that. But here's what we're really resistant. I call it level 3, resisting their resistance. So if I know what they're going to say, if I'm coaching someone, they go, okay, you just don't understand. I already know what they're going to say. I'll say, are you willing to have the conversation anyway? even though you know what they're going to say? They might cry. I understand. They might cry. Are you willing to have the conversation even though they might cry? I might feel really embarrassed. I understand. Would you be willing to feel some embarrassment in order to try?
It's the desire not to have someone resist you. It's not even the fact that it's literally, I'm saying I'm resisting someone else who might resist me because of the fact they would resist me. That's what you're talking about. And you're going, okay, well, objection dies with agreement. You're in reverse. You're saying, hey, look, I agree with you. But would you do it anyway?
And yeah, go test it out. Call me back and tell me what they said. Go do it. Go try it. Because really, the reason that they're showing up the way they do is because you always show up the way you do. So you're part of that pattern. If you change the way you do it, they automatically have a different energy and response just because the pattern shifted just by you doing it.
That's right.
I always say it's always three layers down and it's never about the first thing you think it is. So what I call willingness is the fulcrum point of change. In other words, nothing happens until there's a state of willingness. So if you think that it's because they're not willing, the truth is you're not willing to have them not be willing. That's really the truth. It's just, are you willing? And so I call that the magic phrase, would you be willing? And if someone says, someone says you're coaching someone, you say, would you be willing to work on second shift next week to train with Mike? If someone says, no, I'm not willing, that's not necessarily resistance. That's clear that he's not going to do it, but there's consequences with that clarity.
Sure. Yeah. It's a trade-off. Fine.
You can't work here.
Right.
But you still have a choice, but your choice is going to have a consequence. So I can say, would you be willing? And willingness is the fulcrum point of change. But if I won't even ask them to be willing, I'm the bottleneck, not them.
That's right. And here's the thing. If that person has the choice and they choose to go and work that and train, then it makes it less likely or at least less reasonable that they would sit there and just bemoan it the whole time or not go in and do it because they chose it. It was their choice. Now, as a leader or manager, I'm going to say, hey, go and work this. Then all of a sudden it's, man, he made me do it. I didn't even want to be here. And you've taken that choice away from them. What you've done is you've seeded an opportunity for them to harbor feelings of bitterness or a grudge or whatever because they didn't have the choice. So I love that. I love because it also gives them, there's no difference in the consequences. There's no difference in the trade-off. The trade-off is still the trade-off. It's just they have a perception and I would say the reality of a choice, whereas the other way they perceive they don't have a choice, even though they do. So I love that. I really love that. So let me ask you this. In your career, as you made the jump from where you were in your career into this special like new area of consulting and speaking and writing, has there been anyone that was a great mentor for you that you felt like you leaned on and really you looked at and said, this person is who I'm looking to as a model, or this was an individual in my life that really helped me navigate some of these waters?
Gosh, I've never thought about that in depth because there wasn't just like one person that I studied under and I mentored under. I've got several little examples of people that either encouraged me or gave me an opportunity. Although they were small opportunities, it was still just the next right step. Yeah. I do remember in my master's, whenever I was a little bit stuck because business was flailing because I just didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have business savvy at that time. And I'm like, I don't want to be non-productive because I've quit a job now. I can't just sit around and hope the good fairy brings me a client. So I'm like, what can I do? What can I do? So I start going and get my master's degree. And this, I would say this was just, it was not like great mentoring, but it was a great thing that connected for me when I was like, I don't know, this is expensive. I'm paying for it out of my own pocket and I'm not making money. I quit this job. I'm in this weird place. This one professor said, you need to stick this out and you need to get your master's degree. Of course, everybody that's in education thinks that's the only path, right? It's not. You know, that's how it is. And he said, you need to like get your PhD, just keep going, get a second one, that'll do it. But he's do your master's because it'll pay off. I'm like, how's it going to pay off really? And he said, because you'll do a research project at the end, and it's called a capstone. And that capstone can lay the foundation for everything you're going to do. And it can be like Stephen Covey. And I thought,
wow.
Not only do I not understand what capstone means, and do I think I'm smart enough to do research or focused enough, but he's saying something that could be something to it. So I think I'll just keep going. And I did. And that did become a foundation because I studied workplace drama. But the reason I studied that is because I had learned about this tool called the Karpman Drama Triangle. And it's a big component in a lot of my work. And so when I learned about the victim, the persecutor, and the rescuer, I used that word to talk about interactions in the workplace. And then that became my research. So it's been threaded through the whole time.
Oh, my gosh. I am familiar with the drama triangle. I have seen that before. So that is so fascinating. It's so cool. Isn't it wild how little conversations like that can make such a huge impact on the trajectory of career and life? Man, that's awesome.
Well, and also, I was talking about this. I think you'll enjoy this. I was talking about this with a friend of mine the other day. This is so distant. It's really almost hard to remember. And I want to give people credit that gave me that choice and that chance. But sometimes you're just in your drama so much, you don't even know when it is a choice or a chance. You're just trying to, you know, survive, climb the mud hill. But there was a guy that worked out there where I worked, and he was a trainer. Maybe he was a safety trainer, or maybe he was a trainer. I can't remember. Right. But his name was Ken Marshall. And like, I hadn't even quit. I was 3 or 4 years away from quitting. And I remember talking to him and saying, I'd love to do what you do. It looks fun. I think I like to teach and just motivational to train. And he actually said, I'll tell you what, I'm doing a training out at this manufacturing plant next week. Why don't you just build a little 30-minute something and I'll let you do it? That's pretty amazing when I think about that, because I didn't know how to dress professionally. I think when he showed up to pick me up, I maybe had shorts on. And I didn't know. And I didn't know. Anyway, so I compare that with someone else that works there that was in HR that did some trainings. And I went to him and I said, I'm just struggling. I know I've got more to offer. But see, they don't see you as anything more than what you currently are, because they don't, it's not that world, right? That world a world you can be in a trajectory. And I never even heard about career path. I didn't even know what that meant. I didn't even know what that meant. So I go to him and I say, I'd just love to do what you do. And here was his stance. You think this is easy? You're sitting back thinking you could do what I can do? You don't know what all I do every day. And I said, I'm not saying I do. I'm just saying it looks fun. It's not just fun. I work hard and I'm like, okay. And it was really discouraging. So that's how I know when someone's enlightened, because there's people honestly that call me and I get it. Like, they're like, hey, could you tell me how to write a book or how to start a speaking career? And I'm like, oh my God, that's saying I'm in the middle of the ocean, which way to shore? And so when you don't know, you don't know. You don't know, you don't know. It looks like I just made this happen. Like, you looked at this photograph of me, like in the year 2000, and now you look at it, like, how'd that happen? Wow, there's three pictures in here. No, my gosh, there's albums.
That's exactly right. You have no idea what goes underneath when you start peeling the layers. It's amazing the amount of effort and work. And then somebody's, I think I'll do that tomorrow, next week. Can you tell me how it is? No. This is not how that works.
That's what I love about young people. I've had people say, oh my God, I'm so excited. I'm starting a YouTube channel. I'm starting a podcast. And then when I see it, their first one is amazing. Come to find out, it took them 4 weeks to do it. And they hired people to help them. I'm like, okay, this isn't sustainable. You think this is what it takes? This isn't it.
It's so good. It is so true, because there's so much, I think, too, pressure for young entrepreneurs, young leaders to have it right out of the gate, because there's so much proliferation of this, whatever perfect is, right? And the social media has been not coming used to. You just have to wait till the next month that Fortune, Forbes, or Inc. magazine comes out. Now you can get it every second on social media. So I think that just the barrage of this is what I have to be and look like to achieve success, I think it's really stolen a lot of what you've talked about earlier is authenticity from young leaders, and also completely misses the set, like the expectations on what the grind is really about, you know, and what
the
sense is really about.
I think it's confusing to everyone. I mean, every now and then I'm thinking, should I get a cat and a turtle and put it on YouTube, or should I be shocked? What am I supposed to be doing? Because this person, they got the knowledge and the wisdom of Job and Aristotle, and they're 20. How are they doing that? Like, I don't know how they're doing it. That's pretty amazing to me, and it can be confusing at any age. You know, they've got 50,000 followers, and they've got a cat and a turtle, and apparently they're making money from
it. It is. And that's, and I'm not knocking anyone that you know, can go and start a, and neither are you, know, starting a YouTube channel is great. But I would say that for most people, it is a process, and engaging in that's the journey. And that's the fun part of it. So I really appreciate it, because as we go through that, we're going to meet people that are for us, some that are against us, some that are going to help us and give us a hand up, and some that are not. And we're going to experience conflict along the way. I cannot tell you how awesome our conversation has been. You've talked about the three life trajectories and had some great questions about that. You've given us some information about how to release that resistance. And we've talked about the three A's. It's just, you have just covered the gamut, the inner game, the outer game. We have had the best conversation. We have two things and we'll close it up. One is, what would you tell a young leader that is just starting out as they're coming into, maybe they're just new into their role in leadership? What advice would you give them? And then the last thing is, we always ask the guests on The Last 10% who they would like to hear as a guest on The Last 10%. So I'll let you roll that.
Okay. I'd say live by this, that in all drama, there's always a lack of clarity. The one with clarity navigates the ship, and clarity can change any situation. So if all you think of is clarity can change any situation, then in every conflict, you'll understand that there's somewhere where someone is not clear, and clarity will change the situation. I live by that with coaching people that are just beyond brilliant. And I used to think, oh, I'm just not smart enough to help them. And I'd be like, I'm not supposed to be smart like them. They know what they know, and that's what they're supposed to do. My job's to help them get clear about all the things going on in their mind. So clarity can change. You won't be able to do everything that everyone does that you're leading. You won't be as smart as them in certain ways, but you can help them maintain and get clarity on what they need to do.
The last one is, who would you like to hear as a guest on The Last 10%?
I love Ben Hardy. He's just really smart, and he's big now. He's really big and very busy. I love Daniel Priestley. He's great for entrepreneurs, and he's just really, really smart. But there's
No, those are two great ones. I love it. I love it. Marlene, this has just been a pleasure. It has been fun. And I'm so thankful that you got to come on The Last 10%. And how can people get in touch with you if they want to order a book, take a LinkedIn course? Mm-hmm. What's the best ways that people get in touch with you?
Yeah, you can, Marlene Chisholm, marlene@marlenechisholm.com is my website. There's some resources and things to sign up for. I'm also on LinkedIn. So if you want to say you heard me on this show, you can go on there and follow me or connect with me and mention this show as well. And so you can find me on LinkedIn real easy, and also my website.
Awesome. We'll put all of that in the show notes. So if you're driving, don't worry, we got you covered. And thank you again, Marlene. And we look forward to maybe having you back on the show again sometime. That'd be great.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today on The Last 10%. We hope you found today's content engaging and encouraging. Remember to subscribe to the podcast to hear the latest episodes, and help us out by rating and reviewing us so others will join our community. We release new episodes every other Tuesday. This podcast can be found globally in any podcasting app, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Amazon. Subscribe today. Plus, visit our website, join our email list, and discover resources and info for your business and team at thinkmovethrive.com. Thanks again for listening to The Last 10%.